This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report. Produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
The U.S. economy, it has suffered a serious slowdown, with the resulting increase in underemployment and unemployment. Poverty is expanding and it's deepening. But don't mourn. Organize. Capture the moment with Building Bridges as we explore with Van Jones how the greening of America is both a moral imperative and provides the nuts and bolts of real economic stimulus.
Now is the time to re-energize the discussion, too long dormant, about who creates wealth and its redistribution to those who do. Planting the seeds with Van Jones, from which will sprout a real bailout for workers of the U.S.
Van Jones is an author, he's an activist, and he's written The Green Collar Economy, How One Solution Can Fix Our Two Biggest Problems. Our good friend Van Jones, outstanding, best-selling author of The Green Collar Economy, and now we hear author Van Jones.
It's interesting to be here at a time where we're actually in some ways moving from opposition to proposition. There's been a tremendous, as you have undoubtedly noticed, breakdown in our economic system, in our financial system. A lot of us almost 10 years ago in the streets of Seattle were pointing out that the direction that we were beginning to move was going to wind up creating exactly what it created. Globalization is, globalized risk, it's globalized poverty, it's accelerated the global deterioration of the world's environment, that economy, much heralded, has now begun to crash down. So in some ways that's a really bad thing. When you have these kinds of wrenching changes, it's better to have planning, it's better to have preparation, it's better to have people prepared, as because we're crashing, because the floor is being torn out from under the people. Folks are losing their homes. People are losing their jobs. People who've gone to work every day and sometimes two jobs are losing their pensions, they're losing their 401ks. So it's a bad outcome. And at the same time, sometimes something really bad has to happen in order for something really good to happen. You might notice that in your own personal lives. It's not after you've had 7 really great days in a row that you say, hey, I'm going to start dieting and change everything, you know? I mean, it's when you've had a really bad day. You get a bad diagnosis or fail a test or lose your job or lose a relationship. That's when you sit down, when you have that breakdown. That's when you sit down and really reassess. And sometimes a breakdown can open the door for a breakthrough. And I think that that is one way to look at what's happening right now. We're having a tremendous breakdown in our economy and in the financial system, but it can open the door to a breakthrough. And in many ways, though the floor has been torn out from under the people, the recent acceleration of popular movements in this country, a lot of it centering on the presidential election, a lot of popular movements pouring into the presidential election, the historic nature of that election in terms of the race and gender dynamics in that election, in some ways have also torn the ceiling off. So the floor is gone, but in some ways the ceiling is gone as well. And the question is, are we going to fall or fly? And I would say whether we fall or fly is more in the hands of the people than it is in the hands of any of the elected officials. So the question is, how are we going to fly? That's the question. And I think in order to understand how it is that we can fly, we need to understand with more specificity why we were falling, and what are the fallacies that led to the most recent collapse. Now we can, those of us in this audience, we can go back 500 years and just start pointing out some pretty basic fallacies and flaws in terms of our economic system. But you really only have to go back 30. And I think it's important to at least go back 30, because I've heard too much talk about the past 8 years as if the 90s were some kind of cakewalk for working folks, or some kind of cakewalk for marginalized people, oppressed people, people of color. I remember the 90s as a time when the prison population was doubled. We went from having 1 million people behind bars to having 2 million people behind bars, mostly People of color are almost entirely low-income people, mostly for nonviolent offenses, many of those drug offenses. People doing the same drugs that I saw folks, as my brother Monty here, saw folks doing those drugs at Yale, and they weren't going to prison. If they got caught with those drugs, they would wind up going to rehab. A lot of those people wound up as doctors, lawyers, president of the United States. You know, it's a well-worn pathway from rich folks' homes to rehab centers and back to success. Very similar to the pathway for low-income people to the prison house for the same offenses. So we know that the 90s were actually a very bad period. We also know that the 90s were a period when the right-wing forces that eventually were able to take over the Republican Party and the all three branches of the federal government and imposed 6 years of one-party authoritarian rule on the country, those forces actually cut their teeth and got strong in the 90s, beating up on people of color, attacking on issues like welfare, attacking on issues like immigrant rights, attacking on issues like mass incarceration, attacking on affirmative action, attacking people of color and marginal people, and basically getting stronger at our expense. Meanwhile, a lot of the forces that have taken the field more recently to oppose Bush and Bushism were silent during the 90s. So it was only very recently I said, oh my God, there's a right-wing, you know, movement in this country, and it's terrible. Like, who are you telling that to? You know, some of us would wear that for quite some time. And so I say that to say that it's important for us not to fall into the trap of thinking that it was just George Bush, that it was just the past 8 years. We could go back 500 years if we wanted to. We can certainly go back 30. And for the past 30 years, both political parties have promoted an economic philosophy that has three fallacies built into it. And the three fallacies of the most recent kind of economic fad were, number one, that the U.S. economy could go on forever basing itself primarily on consumption rather than production. That we could just, in the name of globalization, send all the productive capacity to other countries. We wouldn't need to have any factories here. We wouldn't need to have a strong working class here. We could just base our economy based on going to the mall, shopping online, going to strip malls, going to Walmart. That we would just do all the consumption and that the production would take place someplace else. Well, the past 4 to 5 years, we've been consuming in the United States more, sometimes 4, 5, 6% more than we've been producing. That is by definition not sustainable, but that was the promise of globalization, that we could do that forever and it work out just fine. The second big fallacy was the idea that we would be able to go on forever basing the U.S. economy based on debt, credit, as opposed to thrift and smart savings like our grandparents. That is something that, again, we were told we could just keep doing that forever. The big flaw, one big flaw in the world economy is that, frankly, Americans spend too much, save too little. Our sisters and brothers in Asia, especially in China, save too much and spend too little. As a result, they tend to, you know, and God bless them in China, they tend to have a big pile of cash looking for places to lend it. And we tend to have big piles of credit cards looking for people to borrow from. And that big imbalance in the world economy has, you know, kept going and going and going. And we somehow began to believe we could just keep the economy going based on borrowing rather than building, based on credit rather than creativity. That basic fallacy, again, you know, you don't have to be a genius to figure out. You can't just keep doing that forever. So we built the economy up on credit cards, on hawking our houses. People were, you know, hawking their homes to buy flat-screen TVs to cover the holes in their lives. People were, you know, the government, you know, also went on a credit card binge called T-bills. But at the end of the day, that proved to be something that can't go on forever. By definition, not sustainable. And the third, and probably the most important, from the point of view of the children of all species, the idea that we could run the U.S. economy forever based on environmental destruction rather than ecological restoration, that we could just go on with this economy that's primarily based on taking beautiful living things, killing them, shrink wrapping them, and trying to get them through people's houses and into the incinerators and landfills as quickly as possible. So people can go back and do it again and again, and calling that growth. as opposed to calling that ecological suicide. Well, that those three fallacies, consumption rather than production, debt rather than thrift and smart savings, and environmental destruction rather than ecological restoration, those three fallacies characterize the economic policy of both major political parties for 30 to 40 years, not just the past eight. And that is the economy that just crashed. There is a new economy that is trying to emerge. And it is in that economy that we can begin to place some hope. And it is simply the reverse of the economy that just crashed, an economy that would be based on production, local production, people actually working and doing things and building things and making things, based on thrift rather than credit cards, and based on ecological restoration. And that economy can be called the green economy, or in the title of my book, the green collar economy. It is that economy I believe will become the cornerstone of the next American economy. Up until very recently, there was a tendency to think about the green economy as either for the eco-chic or the eco-freaks, right? I'm from the Bay Area, so we know a lot about the eco-freaks. The good hippies and tree-hugging folks in the Bay Area who are culturally different enough from the rest of America to do things in a different way. Or if you go down to Southern California, you can find the eco-chic, the eco-elite, who are economically different enough from the rest of America to do things in a different way. But it was assumed that that would be a niche economy, a marginal economy, an economy of choice, either people paying a green premium to buy their way into this sort of elite economy, or people operating off of a different set of values and opting out of the mainstream economy. But it would be considered ludicrous, even 6 months ago, certainly 1 or 2 years ago, to say that the majority of the U.S. economy would have to become a quote-unquote green, earth-honoring economy, again based on local production, thrift, and ecological values. However, that is the only part of the U.S. economy that is likely to survive this incredible global economic catastrophe that we are just at the beginning of, and it will become the cornerstone of the next American economy. Now, we have some choices to make as progressives, especially in light of the fact that now every party in the United States calls itself a Green Party. You have the original Green Party, but the Democratic Party, if you went to their convention as I did, they think they're a Green Party. John McCain, talks about was talking about clean energy and this kind of stuff. There's been a wholesale adoption of green values and green rhetoric, and yet emissions continue to go up, and no laws have been passed to do anything about it. The question we face now as progressives, this is a very confusing period. We are now seeing the rise of new phenomena in American politics. I call it the rise of the dirty greens. It used to be that you had the clean greens, those of us who are serious about ecological transformation and especially its ability to create more work, more wealth, and more health for ordinary people. And then you had the dirty, polluting people who we didn't like, and we just fought each other all the time. Well, now everybody's jumping the fence over here into the green space. You're used to corporate greenwashing, where corporations say that they're green, their packaging looks green, they have some pretty trees on the packaging, but it's the same dirty, polluting process and the same toxic product as before. That's called corporate greenwashing. Well, now we're seeing political greenwashing. We're seeing a phenomenon develop where even a John McCain will say, oh, I'm for solar power, I'm for wind, I'm for clean energy, but I'm also for oil shale, tar sands, liquefied coal. I'm for all of the above, right? That's how they say it. We're for all of the above. We love all your clean green stuff, but we're also for oil shale, tar sand, liquefied coal, drilling off our coast, burning kittens, you know, any carbon-based, no morals, you know, path to, you know, toward you know, repowering the country. Therefore, well, that's very confusing for people. And so we're now going to have to draw much clearer lines and be much, much clearer about what we are standing for. This is a challenge for progressives. But at the same time, we're now having the right conversation We're having the right conversation. How do we repower the country? How do we retrofit the country? And in doing so, recognizing it's now it's not only a moral issue or an ecological issue, it's now going to become a tremendous economic issue. The president-elect says he wants to spend $150 billion over the next 10 years, $150 billion with a B, over the next 10 years, investing public money into clean energy and energy conservation, which I think is tremendous. I applaud the president-elect for that. The question is, who's going to get that money? That's a question I think is right to ask. Who's going to get that money? $150 billion, that's a lot of money. If you want to be equitable about it, let's just say African Americans, just to pick a community, are 10% of the country. Now, we're probably 20% because our folks run from census folks, assuming it's, cops or bill collectors or something. But assume that we're 10% of the population. Well, 10% of $150 billion, that's $15 billion. That's a lot of money. There are very few problems you couldn't solve in the black community if you had $15 billion. We have a lot of problems. We don't have that many problems. If you had $15 billion, that's a lot of money. Latino communities, let's just say, it's 10%. So if you want to be equitable about this transformation, then there's some real questions that have to be asked and answered. The president-elect says he wants 5 million green jobs by the end of his first term. I think they're saying 2.5. But let's just stick with the original number. 5 million green jobs. That's jobs in the solar industry, in the wind industry, retrofitting buildings, et cetera. Well, again, 10% of that, it's like 500,000 jobs for African Americans, 500,000 jobs for Latinos. How do we go about ensuring that if we build a green economy, that it's a green economy that is characterized by eco-equity and not eco-apartheid? How do we build a green economy that Dr. King would recognize and be proud of? How do we ensure this green wave that the president-elect wants to create lifts all boats? How do we make sure that we green the ghetto first, as Majora Carter from the Sustainable South Bronx says? If you want to be, you don't have to be moral about it, if you just want to be effective about it, you cannot beat global warming, for instance, without greening the cities. Cities are 75% of the greenhouse gas problem. Trucking the food in, buildings that leak a lot of energy, all the traffic patterns, what have you. So 75% of your global warming problem, that's what you're trying to beat, cities. So if you're going to make a difference in global warming, you've got to green the cities. Well, where should you start? Well, you should probably start where the homes are the leakiest with regard to energy, because an old building where poor folks tend to live that's drafty, has cracks in the wall, the glass is rattling in the pane, which means energy is leaking out. That old drafty building creates chilly people, but it creates a hot and overheated planet. Why? Because when you have a building that is leaking energy, that's not efficient with regard to energy, the power plant has to go work 30% harder to heat and cool that building. So if you're going to have a program for mass energy conservation, efficiency, weatherization, you should start with poor folks. In other words, you should go there first. You should make those homes efficient. You should weatherize those homes first. You should put solar panels up on those homes first. You should give people jobs going into those homes first, bringing clean, non-toxic insulation. Not just any old insulation, but clean, non-toxic insulation and non-toxic caulk, so you aren't sealing up homes and making people sick. You should give people jobs going into double-pane that glass. That's a job. Replacing that old boiler that might be 20, 30 years old, 40 years old, with a new, efficient boiler. Replacing ill-fitting doors. Everything that's good in the fight against global warming is a job. Everything that's good for the environment. It's a job. It's a career path. It's an entrepreneurial opportunity. It's work. Solar panels don't manufacture themselves and put themselves up. Wind turbines don't manufacture themselves. They don't put themselves up. None of the things that we need to do to make our communities healthier and more respectful of the earth can be done outside of the context of labor, outside of the context of work. We can put Detroit back to work, but not making SUVs or slightly more efficient, big clunky cars that are going to destroy the world, but making wind turbines and solar panels that can help save the world. A wind turbine. We're not talking about a windmill here. Let's be clear. Don't look in your nursery book trying to find a windmill to get the visual on what I'm talking about. We're talking about wind turbines. Think Boeing-level engineering. 8,000 finely machined parts in each wind turbine. That's a car, okay? A wind tower has 20 tons of steel, all right? So you could put your auto workers back to work and your steel workers back to work, just creating enough wind turbines to begin to get the plain states where we have a lot of our wind resources going. And let's be clear, 60 to 70% of our wind resources are on Native American land. So there's an opportunity to then bring work and wealth to Native Americans, not have another generation of broken treaties, but actually let them reap the benefits of the resources on their land. There is a whole future out there. And so then all the questions that we as progressives would raise about work and about labor in terms of equal opportunity, equal access, fairness, labor rights, union rights, all those now need to be raised in this context as the government now undergoes possibly the biggest spending spree that it's gone on since World War II, much of it in the name of jumpstarting the U.S. economy with clean energy. I applaud the president-elect and everybody who has recognized we're at the end of the road for the consumerist locomotive for the U.S. economy. The U.S. economy is the most important economy in the world and the biggest economy in the world, not because we're the biggest producers, but because we're the biggest consumers. And we are at the end of the road for that. China is not going to be able to foot the bill for that forever. We are at the end of the road for that. And God bless India and China. We want India and China to have great economies. There's also this thing that's now happening where we're supposed to be mad at India and mad at China because they want to grow their economies. They have hundreds of millions of people in the most shocking kinds of poverty. The poorest person in the United States would be shocked by some of the poverty in India and in China. So we want those economies to grow. But here's what we don't want. If you're a poor person in India, a low-income person in India or China, you shouldn't have to leave your village, leave your family, leave your language group, especially in China, just got back from China, and then crowd yourself into a polluted megacity to make crap for us to buy at Walmart as your only pathway out of poverty. If you are living anywhere in the world, you should have the right to participate in a local green economy where it was homegrown clean energy and to move people into a better way of life from that position, a better way of life from the position of strong local green economies. We want that for India and China. We want that for Latin America and Africa, and we want that for the United States. We want to be able to pull people out of poverty into local, sustainable economies, and not economies that are based always on quantitative growth, but are based on the improvement of quality of life. You've got to begin to shift to a different calculus for how it is that you are alleviating poverty. All this is available out of a true pathway to a green economy. It's an answer for the global problem of global warming and global poverty. But there are many sidetracks and diversions and ways for this to become a big corporate boondoggle that neither addresses the problem of poverty nor addresses global warming. This could be a big corporate boondoggle that actually doesn't cut greenhouse gas emissions and doesn't create jobs, and therefore we miss a tremendous opportunity. So the book, The Green Collar Economy, attempts to lay out some pathways forward. Attempts to explain and to express how it is that ordinary folks who can't afford a Prius, who can't afford to put solar panels on their second home, that's not the first thing on their minds when they wake up in the morning, how they're going to put a solar panel on their second home, or how they're going to go to Whole Foods, which we call Whole Paycheck, and try to get some healthy food for their kids. What about the folks who can't afford to go to Whole Paycheck, who can't afford forget a hybrid, struggling for bus fare right now. Do they have a place in this green economy that both parties are now jumping up and down about? And if so, what is that place? And is it a place of dignity and honor where there are real pathways to success, green careers, and not a solar sweatshop economy? These are the questions now for progressives to take very, very seriously. But it's my strong conviction that if we address ourselves to these questions and take them very seriously, that we can build an inclusive green economy, We can build a green economy that lets us not only power our way through this recession by repowering this country with clean energy, but also lets us get off the path of oil wars and resource wars with Asia, which is where we're headed. If we decide to go from being the world leader in pollution in this country to the world leader in solutions, we can help the rest of the world boot up clean, power up clean. We can have a green and thriving partnership with the rest of the world. And I think that that is the best way forward. So in conclusion, it is my fervent hope that progressives will not hold back in this struggle. There's been, especially in the African-American community, there's been a dismissiveness around these questions of green politics and green economics. I would say that it's actually third world people and people of color, indigenous people, whose at least original value set is most inclined in the direction of respecting the earth, honoring the earth. If our great-great-grandparents could talk to us, especially our great-great-grandmothers, all of us from Europe, Asia, Africa, and Latin America, they would say that the values of honoring the earth, the values of respecting life, respecting our sister and brother species, and respecting our sisters and brothers, are not white values, are not elite values. They're the values that our folks were called savages, pagans, called witches, burned at the stakes over, and that for us to usher their wisdom back into the world in this new century is our highest duty and our highest calling. So thank you.
Van Jones' speech was delivered at a book talk at Blue Stockings Bookstore in New York City on December 4th, 2008.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our new website at
www.buildingbridgesradio.org. Buildingbridgesradio.org.